Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. This is, of course, James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and today is the 7th of August, 2014, which is 69 years and one day to the day after the bombing of Hiroshima, and 69 years minus 2 days from the atomic bombing of Nagasaki back in 1945 at the end of the Second World War. And listeners to the podcast earlier this week will have caught my conversation with Dr. Gary Coles, a contributor to DuluthReader.com, about his recent article, The Hiroshima Myth and the Glorification of American Militarism. Well, I suppose this conversation today might be seen as a part two to that conversation. Today, we're going to be talking to another contributor to DuluthReader.com, John LaForge, the author of the recent article, Censorship and Mythmaking: Enshrined Ignorance of Hiroshima and the Bomb, which will, of course, be linked up in the show notes for this interview, as always, at CorbettReport.com. John LaForge is also a member of NukeWatch, working for a nuclear-free future at NukeWatchInfo.org. Which, of course, will also be linked up in the show notes. John LaForge, thank you very much for joining us on the program today.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
Excellent. Well, this is your first time on the program, and again, as is customary with first-time guests, it's good to find out a little bit about yourself and the work that you do, including the work that you do for NukeWatch. Perhaps you can tell us about that organization and what it's involved with.
Oh, sure. We're a nonprofit peace and environmental action group located in northern Wisconsin. Been in business since 1979, founded in Madison, Wisconsin, and moved to a small town in the northwest part of the state back in 1996. We focus our attention on nuclear weapons, nuclear waste, nuclear power, and the problems with the dangers of radiation. In particular, publish a quarterly newsletter and operate a informational website that you already mentioned, NukeWatchInfo.org. We have four people on staff, so it's a small nonprofit, but we're committed to abolition of nuclear power and weapons.
Well, then let's talk a little bit about that recent article that I mentioned before, Censorship and Mythmaking: Enshrined Ignorance of Hiroshima and the Bomb. Now, this does cover some of the same, I suppose, some of the same ground that we were talking to Dr. Gary Coles about earlier this week, but invokes some different pieces of this puzzle, talking about how the official myth of Hiroshima and its necessity was ingrained in the United States population shortly after the war, and some of the pieces of that puzzle that point to the fact that it is, in fact, a carefully constructed myth. Perhaps you can tell us just a little bit about the article and the information it conveys.
Yes, well, the U.S. public is virtually unaware of all the censorship that took place, censorship of photographs, films, and factual information about the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And there have been a couple of books recently published, one of them by Greg Mitchell, called Atomic Cover-Up, which pulled the curtain back from this cover-up and explained the great lengths to which the Army, Air Corps, the U.S. occupation forces in Japan, the State Department, the Defense Department, and the White House went to cover up and secret information, or classify it as secret, for decades, in order to maintain this myth and this cover story that the bombings actually saved lives instead of, as they did, take hundreds and hundreds of thousands of lives. The cover-up also succeeded in convincing people that the war wouldn't have ended without these bombings, when in fact historical records now unearthed due to declassification of formerly secret documents prove beyond any question that the Japanese were already defeated. They were suing for peace through their emissaries with the Soviet Union at the time to arrange a surrender, and the bombings were completely unnecessary to bring about Japan's surrender. All this information is now publicly available in a series of excellent books. One 2013 by Ward Wilson called Five Myths About Nuclear Weapons. The most lengthy coverage of this issue is by Gar Alperovitz, his 780-page book, The Decision to Use the Atomic Bomb. And also an earlier book by Robert Lifton and Greg Mitchell called Hiroshima in America, 50 Years of Denial. That delves deeply into the question of the cover story used by Truman and Secretary of State James Burns and the military to convince people not to feel guilty about this pair of massacres at the close of World War II.
Now, in the article, you do quote from that work by Mitchell and Lifton, Hiroshima in America, 50 Years of Denial, which quotes General Leslie Groves, the head of the Manhattan Project, saying that, quote, "We didn't want MacArthur and others saying the war could have been won without the bomb," the implication being that it was that the real formation of this myth was coming directly from the Manhattan Project itself and from General Leslie Groves. Do you have more information along those lines about where this myth really originated and how it was propagated?
Yeah, as I mentioned, Gar Alperovitz's book goes into great detail about how this was manufactured, this mythological saving of lives and ending of the war was quite deliberately manufactured by people with Leslie Groves in the Manhattan Project and within the State Department. And as you point out, Groves was worried about a raft of military people who have later, since the bombings, come out and said that neither the atomic bombing nor the entry of the Soviet Union into the war forced Japan's unconditional surrender. She was defeated before either of these events took place. That was Brigadier General Bonnie Feller. Many other military people reached the same conclusion. Admiral William Leahy, who was the wartime chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said in his memoirs, "It's my opinion that the use of this barbarous weapon at Hiroshima and Nagasaki was of no material success in our war against Japan. The Japanese were already defeated and ready to surrender." And one of the interesting things about Leslie Groves is fear about MacArthur claiming that the bombs weren't needed to end the war. The interesting point there is that thousands and thousands of U.S. servicemen lost their lives in the war in the Pacific, and those fatalities, those sacrifices are the ones that won the war in the Pacific. And that's why MacArthur was eager to say that his battles, the island hopping they did to take over the Japanese occupations, and those were the victories in battle that eventually pushed Japan to the brink of surrender. And the bombings had to do much more with ending the war in a hurry to maintain control and make sure the U.S. was the occupier of Japan and not the Soviet Union, which was and did enter the war, had promised Truman at Potsdam to enter the war in August, and it did declare war and enter the war against Japan on August 8th, the day before Nagasaki. 6 hours after news of the USSR's invasion of a Japanese island, 6 hours after that, the Japanese Supreme War Command met to hurriedly begin surrender negotiations, and that was well before they got news of the Nagasaki bombing. So yes, the historical record makes it very clear that the atom bombs had nothing to do with the end of the war. They were much more to do with an experimental use of a new weapon in a diplomatic wall raised against the Soviet occupation of Japan.
Well, this brings up such an interesting point to the Hiroshima myth, which, of course, is commonly referred to and understood as the Hiroshima myth, and much of the emphasis is given on Little Boy, the bomb that was exploded over Hiroshima on August 6, 1945. But it seems that the other bomb is almost the forgotten bomb in this equation, Fat Man, which, of course, was dropped over Nagasaki on August 9, 1945. And it seems to me that it's pretty fundamental to the Hiroshima myth, that if the idea was that the, I guess, the 1945 equivalent of shock and awe of killing 140,000 people in the blink of an eye was what was supposedly needed to bring this war to a close, then how can it possibly fall into that that narrative that a second bomb was needed to kill a further 70,000 people to further demonstrate that this could be done? I don't see any way that that could even possibly be shoehorned into this narrative. And the only, I mean, reasonable assumption is that not only, of course, as you say, was it intended as a message to the Soviet Union, but perhaps probably more to the point, it was intended as an actual experiment to see how this would really function over a city. How is Nagasaki featured in this narrative, or is it generally just sort of relegated to that second bomb type status?
You know, that's a great question. The questions surrounding the use of the bomb in Nagasaki are enormous, and they are mostly unanswered. All these texts that I mentioned earlier, they mention, and they do consider the problems of Nagasaki, but not as much or as deeply as those surrounding Hiroshima. So I had a more difficult time digging into the question of Nagasaki recently, and I just finished another article on this subject of just what you asked that will be in the same reader this week, and then as well at the Counterpunch news site, which also publishes these pieces by me. And what I've discovered is that your mention at the end of your question about the possibility of an experiment, it seems to me, as terrible as it is, that seems to be the only rationale for this. There were several people who have said these things. I'm thinking in particular of the former mayor of Nagasaki, who was mayor from 1979 to 95. His name is Hitoshi Matsushima. He said the reason for Nagasaki was to experiment with the plutonium bomb. Newsweek magazine, August 20th of 1945, ran a story from a journalist who was traveling with President Truman aboard the USS Augusta when Truman got the word of the Hiroshima bombing. Evidently, according to this Newsweek article, Truman announced to his shipmates aboard the Augusta, quote, "The experiment has been an overwhelming success," end quote. So even Truman called it that. Later on, U.S. investigators were sent into Hiroshima a month after the August attacks, September 8th in 1945. Some of these people, formerly with the Manhattan Project, met with Japan's leading radiation expert. His name is Professor Masao Suzuki. He was quite famous for a 1926 paper he had written about radiation experiments on rabbits. But when this expert met with the U.S. investigators, according to Lifton's book, he said to them, "Ah, but the Americans, they are wonderful. It has remained for them to conduct the human experiment." So this is sort of speculative and hard evidence to back up the idea that this was simply an experiment is rather hard to find. But nonetheless, coming 3 days, almost less than 3 days after Hiroshima, it seems clear that the U.S. military wasn't interested in giving Japan time to consider what had happened at Hiroshima and time to actually produce a surrender document. They wanted to try this new plutonium weapon, which was different than the uranium bomb dropped on Hiroshima, to see if it would work. And it seems to me that there's really no other way to understand it. In fact, it seems clear Truman himself now didn't even order this bombing. There were standing orders to use nuclear weapons against Japan as soon as they became available, but there's no record of Truman actually personally ordering the use of the Nagasaki bomb, that it just went ahead in sort of an automated way. After it happened, Truman then halted all atomic bombing, according to the record, and said nothing, no more atomic bombs would be used without his direct order. And that gives an indication, too, of the fact that the military was pushing this agenda and probably did this without Truman's knowledge.
Well, let's consider we are now 69 years after the original event, and the people who were around to witness that event and to even the people who actually participated in that are basically slowly dying away. And of course, we just saw it in recent weeks, the last surviving member of the Enola Gay, Theodore Van Kirk, the navigator of the Enola Gay, just passed away. So we are really, I mean, we are leaving the realm of living memory when we start to talk about these events. Is there a sense that there is now more of a space in the American political discourse to at least entertain this type of counter argument to the myth and propaganda that's been created around this event? Perhaps again indicated by the fact that Caroline Kennedy, the U.S. ambassador to Japan, became only the second U.S. ambassador ever to actually attend the Hiroshima Memorial service yesterday?
I think that's an optimistic view, but it's possible. With all this newly declassified information, at least the professional or the university class students of the issue have become informed about the facts. However, the World War II generation is so inculcated and enamored of this idea that the bomb saved lives, in effect, maybe might have saved the lives of invading troops who then didn't have to invade the islands, that the myth is very, very hard to undo. Case in point was the Smithsonian Museum's attempt to bring some light to the facts when it, in 1995, went to display the Enola Gay, the B-29 bomber that dropped the Hiroshima bomb. They were putting it on display in the Air Museum and initially included with the exhibit some photographs of human victims on the ground. And veterans groups raised such a, and people in Congress, protest against any reality-based exhibit there, that the museum backed down and withdrew almost every single photograph of the real human consequences on the ground of what went on there, and denuded the exhibition of any serious criticism of the official narrative, or the myth, as we call it. There has been some breakthrough, though, as you say, with Carolyn Kennedy attending the memorial. No apology has ever been made, of course, as recently as previous President George W. Bush's State Department made a point of reiterating the myth when one of his officials was asked about it in Japan. And, of course, the possession and continued threatened use of nuclear weapons by the United States almost relies permanently on this myth, because without this psychological belief in the back of your mind that a nuclear weapon could be used in an ethical way, how could the American public continue to pay such enormous amounts of money to maintain and deploy 5,000 or 6,000 nuclear weapons that are still out on submarines, heavy bombers, fighter bombers in Europe, and of course in land-based missiles in the Great Plains? The myth is sort of a psychological crutch that lets people forget about nuclear weapons, put them out of their mind, and imagine that they'd only be used for a good cause. And so we still have to whittle away at this long-standing cover-up that has convinced people that something good could come from the commission of a massacre. An idea, of course, that everybody rejects out of hand when it's put so clearly. But people don't even know of the consequences on the ground, as I said, because according to Atomic Cover-Up by Greg Mitchell, some of the actual newsreel footage from Hiroshima was secret until 1968 and later. Some of the films that were confiscated in Japan weren't even returned to the Japanese until 1970. And so the immediate consequences were virtually unknown to the public for decades, during which time this myth-making was able to take hold of the general consciousness and make a permanent sort of tattoo there where nothing else can be imposed on it.
You know, living here in Japan and working, as I do, covering both the anti-nuclear movement in the nuclear power sense and the nuclear war sense, it is absolutely fascinating to me to see how there has been this wedge driven in the Japanese anti-nuclear movement between those two sides. There's the anti-nuclear weapon movement, which is, I would say, much more prevalent here and much more politically and socially acceptable. There's a large segment of the Japanese population that, as you can imagine, is quite against the idea of nuclear weapons, and it works to abolish nuclear weapons entirely. But that has been very carefully delineated from the anti-nuclear power movement. And of course, nuclear power is still seen as, there's been a lot more stigma attached to that movement. And it's traditionally been only those wild and crazy socialists on the left who would engage in that type of political action. And yet it seems to me that in America, it's almost the exact opposite situation, where nuclear weapons and the right of the United States to have and maintain its arsenal is sacrosanct, whereas there's at least more space for a debate about nuclear power in the American political arena. Working at a something like Nuke Watch, what is your sense of this this kind of bifurcation in the anti-nuclear movement in Japan, in America, and elsewhere?
That's a very interesting point. It is sort of the reverse here. The anti-nuclear weapons movement was enormous back in the 1980s when Ronald Reagan intended to introduce Pershing and cruise missiles in Europe and build 17,000 new nuclear warheads in the United States. And they openly talked about fighting and winning thermonuclear war with the Soviet Union, and resulting in only 20 million casualties. These sorts of public statements coming from the White House created a huge anti-nuclear weapons movement here, which has since that time, since the end of the Cold War and the collapse of the Soviet Union, faded to just a shadow of what it used to be. Nuke Watch, in particular, had 12,000 members in the mid-1980s, and today we have 3,000. So it's a major disinterest going on with regard to nuclear weapons in the U.S., and it's a difficult task to raise these questions and keep them in the public eye without having to do a real dramatic protest, something that we have done for years and years at nuclear weapons sites in the Midwest and around the country. But on the contrary, a nuclear power and the question of whether it can be used as a crutch against climate change is a hot issue in the United States, especially since Fukushima happened in northeast Japan, and because of the fact that nuclear utilities in the United States are having a really hard time convincing investors to build new reactors. So it's an open debate here that's been joined by lots of environmentalists and conservationists who want to see safe, renewable, cheaper, and more quickly built forms of safe energy than new reactors being built here. The question of nuclear weapons policy, though, it's a tricky thing because the U.S. pretends to be in disarmament process, likes to talk about numbers. It's reduced the arsenal from formerly 25,000 to now about 6,000 warheads. And yet these warheads are more accurate and more powerful than the ones that they replaced, and they're mostly hidden on giant submarines that are virtually unaccountable to the U.S. public. And so it's a matter of trying to bring focus to these weapons and to the hypocrisy of the U.S. position of wagging its finger at countries that might even think about developing new ones or developing a new nuclear weapons program while at the same time deploying highly powerful nuclear weapons all over the world.
Well, I mean, even if the reduction in the nuclear arsenal did bring about a proportional reduction in the destructive capacity of that arsenal, I'm not sure if there's really any difference between destroying the world 100 times over and destroying it 20 times over. But at any rate, there's still a large task ahead of all of us who are concerned about these issues. And of course, it is groups like Nuke Watch that continue to be there as the sentinels, taking a look at these issues and warning the public about them. For people who are interested in Nuke Watch specifically, where can they go for more information and how can they support your group and its activities?
Well, you can check out our website at nukewatchinfo.org and be glad to read emails from interested parties too. Our email is nukewatch and the number one at lakeland.org. Oh, I'm sorry, .ws. Maybe you can post that at your site too. And can watch for future news of Nuke Watch. We are going to be reissuing a famous book we published in 1988 called Nuclear Heartland. We're going to do a revised edition. It's about the 1,000 missile silos of the Great Plains, which have, since we published the first book, been reduced to 450. We'd like to see those 450 eliminated, so we are going to reissue our maps. It's sort of an atlas of where these land-based rockets are and encourage people to continue or expand and amplify the protest against them to see them eliminated.
Well, I, for one, am personally very much looking forward to your article on Nagasaki. Will that be released on the actual anniversary itself on Saturday?
Oh, it'll be in today's Reader in Duluth, but the Counterpunch, which is at counterpunch.org, they'll be using it on the weekend, I believe.
Excellent. Well, as I say, I am very much looking forward to that. John LaForge, it's been a pleasure talking to you today. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, you're very welcome.